So, hello everyone, I'm Stephen Downs, as you just learned. And I've called my thing Topics in Distributed Ledger Technology. So it's going to be a bit of a light skip through a bunch of the important issues. Some of it you'll already know, maybe. Some of it other people won't already know. Sorry about the weird green hue on the slides, but that's the projector we've got. It kind of adds an interesting effect, though, I don't think. And the spider, if you're wondering, was in my backyard. So I'm very proud of it. We like to grow insects and things in our backyard.
What was the back on that puppy? Did it have yellow lines and stuff like that?
I didn't look at the back.
Okay, because we had one of those. It caused a panic in the family, and I had to save it. Like you, I like to save the poor little animals.
Yeah.
I have some boys that don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, no, protect the spiders. They're good. And then we grow monarch caterpillars. We've got a fine crop of milkweed this year. So
yes, I noticed. Yeah.
So basically, I'm going to go over some of the core concepts. I'm saying distributed ledger technology rather than simply blockchain because I think it's a wider thing. I'm going to go over some of the major coins. I'm going to look at some of the supporting technologies, things like wallets, etc. That'd be outlined in front of you there. So begin with the core concept, and the core concept really is what in the blockchain world is typically talked about as assets or ledgers, hence distributed ledger technology. I think of it more broadly as data, especially once we get outside the financial realm, educational data, etc. We can look at three major types of ledgers, transactions, which is what Bitcoin focuses on. P gives X to Q. Ethereum, which is an alternative to Bitcoin, also keeps track of states. For example, P has N instances of X, you know, I have $43. And then importantly, it can also keep track of conditions or conditional statements. If this transaction happened, then that transaction can happen, etc. And that's the basis for contracts and applications and such, which we'll talk about in a bit. Another important concept is the idea of distributed ledgers. And what's important about it is that the ledger doesn't exist in one place. The data doesn't exist simply in one place. There are different ways of doing this. Typically, though, in the blockchain, everybody will have a copy of the ledger.
The whole ledger,
okay. Yeah. And so that's a bit different from other systems where some people have part of it, other people have other parts of it, which is a different way of being distributed. But in blockchain especially, everybody has the whole ledger, which means anytime there's a transaction, everybody's ledger gets updated. So a third fundamental concept is cryptographic hash functions, which sounds really complicated, but really is actually fairly simple. Take any input you want, and I've just got, you know, foxes and blue dogs and whatever. You run it through the hash function, you get outside the other side, the digest or the hash, which is a string of digits, hexadecimal typically, and the string is a certain length. Now, there's two things that's really important about the hash function. First of all, it's one way. So you can create the hash from the input, but you can't create the input from the hash. So if somebody has the hash, they're not going to derive the input. And the second thing is that I've forgotten the second thing.
Sensitive.
I don't know. I'll come up with the second thing here.
Digest is always the same, given the same input.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. The If given the input, the digest is always the same, right? If you change the input at all, you change the digest. So if you have the digest and you have some data, you can run it through the hash function yourself to confirm that the data that you have hasn't been changed. It's pretty important. Hashes will form the basis for a bunch of things, including verification of records, signatures, contracts, etc. So now we have the blockchain. There's different ways of constructing them. This is a fairly straightforward way of doing it. So what we have, this at the bottom are the actual transactions that happen. Fred gave Joe 14 bitcoins, making Joe rich, as it turns out. Each of these transactions has a hash, so we know that this transaction can't change, and there's a whole tree of these hashes, and taken together, that creates a block, which is represented in the top picture there. That block is also conjoined with a hash of the previous block. So, and the idea here is that because the next block has the hash of the previous block and so on and so on, you can't change any of the contents without changing the entire chain. So what's important here is that it becomes very difficult under certain conditions to change that whole chain. Now, it's a distributed system, which means that anybody can create a transaction and submit it to the system for as a candidate to be put into a block and encoded as a block. And what happens in, for example, the Bitcoin network is the different nodes in this network rush to try to create a new block. And so the question comes up, what happens if there's two competing blocks? There's different ways that this can happen. One way that this can happen is, you know, different transactions. Another way that, though, that this can happen is somebody's trying to fake transactions or something like that. So there has to be some kind of mechanism for dealing with that. On the left-hand side, there's two major kinds of things that can happen. One of them is called Byzantine fault tolerance. That's the idea where you have bad actors who are trying to scam the system. And then the other thing is just simple crash failure, right? One of your nodes might be out of commission. So you can't rely on 100% consensus to choose which of those two blocks you're going to pick. So there are different mechanisms, and they're represented in the purple at the top. Proof of work, proof of stake, proof of competence, or capacity, and proof of time. The first two are the most popular two. The second two are less common but becoming more prevalent in my view. Bitcoin uses proof of work, and the idea here is that a Bitcoin node has to perform a difficult mathematical computation, and in fact it involves generating a hash of a certain type. And what's key about the proof of work is it's hard to do, but it's easy to prove that you've done it correctly once you've done it, right? So, and for example, we saw the hash function. So take some content, generate a hash, right? Look at that hash. And what you want to do is take the content, add what they call a nonce to it, just a one-time code. Right, so that each time you add a different nonce, we'll just use numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever, right, you get a different hash. So keep doing that until you get a hash that has 8 leading zeros. That's hard to do, right? Really hard to do. It can take whole minutes for advanced computer systems. So you do that, solve that problem, you get that hash, and now you take your new block and you attach it to your the chain, and you publish that chain. Now, everyone else can look at that chain, and they can tell very quickly that, yes, you have done the work, because they have that number, that nonce, plus the data, and they can run it through the hash algorithm and see right away, oh yeah, 8 leading zeros, right? Hard to find, easy to prove. So that's how Bitcoin works. That is the key, the core proof of work. As you know, it takes up a lot of computer time. Comment?
Yeah, question. So why, if you look at Bitcoin, my understanding is, you know, the longer it goes, the longer proof of work takes, mm-hmm. the harder it takes. Is it changing? Is it like
it's built into
zeros,
the system?
Zeros,
it's built into the system, so it gets harder and harder over time. So it was very easy at first, but as and the thing is, and the reasoning is this, at least my take on it, is that as the network becomes more valuable, right, it becomes potentially more profitable to simply recreate the entire chain. So you make the chain harder and harder to duplicate by making the proof of work harder. And the way you can do that is just change the number of leading zeros, right? At the beginning, start with 1 0, and then you move it up to 2, move it up to 3. That's just an example. So you make it harder and harder because it's more profitable.
That's what I was wondering, is how they make it harder. So just they add leading zeros.
Just add leading zeros, yeah. Real simple. So eventually they'd run out of zeros. No, I'm just kidding. But so, and that's how you come to consensus, right? Because if you have two competing chains, you pick the one that represents the most work. And now that's your new authoritative blockchain. Everybody will use that as their base to put the next blocks onto. So, pretty straightforward, but really wasteful. Proof of stake is a bit different. A lot of the consensus mechanisms are the same, but instead of investing a whole lot of money into generating these leading zeros, you basically have a stake in the system. It's like, you know, it's like anteing up, right? And then if you're caught cheating, then there are punishment mechanisms. But again, the idea here of a consensus mechanism is you have a pool of competing things, right? The pool of competing things, you have a mechanism for electing one of them, either by work or stake or whatever, and then that becomes your authoritative blockchain. That's blockchain. That's it in a nutshell. You know, people, of course, have made it really complicated after that, but at core, it's a pretty simple system.
Does the ledger ever end, or does it just continuously grow?
It just continuously grows.
There's no archiving, there's no to say it.
Well, the ledger is the archive, right?
Yeah.
So, there are different ways of organizing the ledger so that it's not just one single long chain. You can create graphs or whatever, but the idea is, yes, there is one ledger and it grows. You know, and I'll let Andre talk more about the different ways of handling that. So far so good?
Yeah.
Interesting?
Very.
Cool. It is interesting. Why are people gaga over this? So the first thing, I mean, it's the idea that you can generate trust among people who don't trust each other, right? Byzantine fault tolerance. Even if there are bad actors in the system, the mechanism of the system plus the hashing and the signing and all of that creates trust. So you don't have to trust the other person. The technology makes it so that it's very difficult and expensive for them to cheat. The idea of consensus. Everybody agrees on the same ledger. So you don't have cases where one company's records are one thing and another company's records are another thing. The provenance, especially with things like Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin tracks transactions. So you can actually see the provenance, where these coins went over time. Can't know who owned them particularly, but you can know where they went. Immutability and finality, right? Once it's in there, it's in there. You don't go back in and change records after. That just doesn't happen, right? Once it's in there, it's in there.
Well, can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
So for blockchain, the immutability comes from the fact that doing the proof of work for the whole chain before somebody comes up with another block is basically impossible.
That's right.
But for the other systems, that's not necessarily the case. So there are different ways to do immutability.
There are different ways to do immutability, absolutely, yeah. The proof of stake, you know, it would cost too much for the participants, right? So it would be a bad bet. Yeah. Now, if one of the participants just wants to see the world burn like the Joker, that might not be as good a mechanism. In other cases, you know, there's an authoritative system, so what they call an oracle might be used to make it impossible to revert. The proof of time was not up there anymore. The proof of time works that way as well. And then finally, maybe one of the benefits is equity, right? Everybody can play. That hasn't turned out to be as true in fact as in theory, because of course, as it becomes more and more expensive to produce new blocks, the capacity to produce new blocks has become more and more centralized, and that's been an issue over time.
Now, when you say more expensive to create new blocks, are you talking more from a financial perspective?
CPU? Bitcoin?
Or computer time.
Computer time. So, yep. So that would begs the question, in our environment, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but in our environment, we're not producing financial currency, we're
right.
Producing records.
Yeah.
So if the cost of creating these blocks is going to gain momentum as far as cost is concerned, computing power, it needs to be consideration for a project. Right?
Absolutely, yeah. You don't want to be in a position where you have to create blocks. But you don't have to create blocks in order to use the system.
Someone does, though.
Someone does, yeah.
And if it becomes cost prohibitive to clients to leverage this tool, at some point, it makes it really difficult to peel it out of their slimy little fingers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
3, 4, 5 years from now, right? When they're used to it, it becomes a table stake.
Yeah.
But when it becomes too expensive to operate, then we're stuck in that position.
But is that due to the blockchain consensus algorithm exclusively, or is it any blockchain will be like that?
As I would say, it's due to the consensus algorithm specifically. But, I mean, there are different aspects of it, right? Like any technology, there's going to be a certain degree of lock-in. That's, you know, you use Windows, it's really hard to switch to Mac.
Absolutely.
Right? So you're going to have that. Like any technology, there are going to be costs. In Bitcoin, in Ethereum, and the rest, these costs are layered. Right, so if you use the internet right now, there's a cost to you, and there's a cost to Google. Google pays billions of dollars for its server center, well, maybe billions, I don't know, a lot, right? You pay $50 a month for internet access, maybe, I don't know. If you're in the country, it's probably like a mortgage on your house. I live in the country, I have views. So, but you don't have to pay for all of Google, right? So Google monetizes in different ways, and that cost is distributed. So in Bitcoin, there are, what is it? I think about 115,000 nodes. It's down in a few slides, right? They're bearing the mining cost, but there's a whole lot more people, organizations in that, working on that platform. And so they're not bearing all of the mining costs themselves. The nodes bear the mining costs, and then they pass off those costs in terms of lower costs. So that's one thing. The second thing is, there's an end point to Bitcoin.
21 million?
Something like that, yeah. And they're not too far from it now, but there is an end point. And what I mean by that is this. Right now, each time a company, it's always a company now, produces a new block and adds it to the blockchain, they're given a reward of a Bitcoin. And that reward has been going up and up and up over time, right? But there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoins ever given away. After that, the incentives to create new blocks will change. And it'll be covered with things like transaction fees, etc. So that's going to be a factor as well. So you have to kind of think of Bitcoin as a two-stage thing, right? First of all, building the blockchain consensus mechanism, and then secondly, using the blockchain consensus mechanism.
But if you don't have this, you know, ever more expensive proof-of-work consensus mechanism, are there any other sources of costs that are going to increase over time? Storage?
Or? Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, storage is, I mean, the price of storage is decreasing faster than the amount of data is increasing.
Right.
So I don't think that's going to be an issue.
I think the scary part is proof of work is exponential, right? It's, that's the scary part. So, you know, if you look at exponential costs, I don't see the same issue if we're doing it different. My question would be, do you have to do a proof of work? Honestly, I know.
That's the point.
And
so if you don't do proof of work and you do something else, you could possibly come up with something that doesn't
kill us
increase the costs later on. But are you going to talk about permission?
Well, that's just it. There's different ways of handling your blockchain. I'll mention permission now because you brought it up, right? So the Bitcoin system is a public system. Everybody can play. In a permissioned blockchain, such as, say, Hyperledger Fabric, which is down the road a bit in my slides, you restrict the people who can participate in the system. So now your incentives and your mechanisms have changed completely, right? You know who is contributing a new block. You still need a consensus mechanism, but you don't need to do a proof of work. You can do a proof of authority, say, this person is authorized to add, right? And then you'll have some other election mechanism, you know, the most time has elapsed, for example. So in that case, if you have a bad actor and bad data was added to the blockchain, you know who did it, and then you can kick them out of your network, right?
So let's say we did it on a client base, who's in our particular use case, right?
Mm-hmm.
We would have, I'll call it authorized companies that would be part of our ship track delivery network that can technically be part of a node system, permission-based. So let's say I found out it was Bob's Trucking out of Nebraska and it came through there. The reality is Bob's Trucking may have been compromised, right, himself. And so without anybody knowing it, it's going through.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get to that state where it's like, well, yes, I can trace it back to Bob's Trucking, but I maybe can't trace it back to behind.
That's right.
That's true. But.
But.
Bob's Trucking is adding new blocks. They're not changing the old blocks.
Right.
Right? So if in the old days, let's say, or if you had a standalone database, somebody could come into Bob's Trucking and change everything, including all Pat's transactions and stuff like that, and then kaput. But with a blockchain, because it's a distributed ledger, because it's peer-to-peer, not because it's blockchain necessarily.
Right.
But if Bob tries to change an old transaction, everybody goes, wait, what the heck?
And so
something's wrong. Cut off Bob now.
You cut off Bob. Bob takes care of his security problem, right? And then has to demonstrate that, okay, we're good now. You can come back in.
But Bob could add new phony baloney blocks.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you would know that.
But
what to what end would be the question, right? What would that gain?
Well, that's
whoever.
Yeah, that's just it, right? The incentives in a system like this really aren't there to game the system, particularly when the cost, you know, being blocked from the system is so high, right? What would they gain? The best they could gain is to try to award themselves some transactions, right? Stuff that I didn't really ship.
In our world, in our world, it's about being able to compromise the system to either change, maybe even change delivery address. So this
Yeah.
This whole thing of military grade plutonium go here instead of here.
Yeah.
It changed the provenance.
Right? Yeah.
Change
well,
the
they can't change. They can add a new one.
They can add. They can't
but
change.
They can't
yeah.
change. So they could say, deliver it to here, and then they could say, well, after it's delivered to there, deliver it to my secret warehouse.
Yeah. So.
Or they could say, if you had a smart contract, where you know, for example, I think this is how smart contracts work. Andre's going to yell at me. So it says, okay, well, when you deliver the thing, there'll be an event, and the smart contract will see the event, and then we'll issue the, and then we'll send an event and say, we'll pay the money, yeah. Right? That's so then Bob's Trucking says, okay, well, I delivered this thing, and then the money gets sent, transferred to Bob's Trucking immediately. The thieves take the money, and then they disappear. So, you know, so that's how you could add a new transaction and make some money.
We're at this today all the time, by the way. Like in the regular business world, this is a huge problem right now,
sure.
where people are intercepting emails. They're getting them, they hack in, they get emails intercept, sent mm-hmm. to, let's say, third party, so Ford. So your email's getting forwarded every day, you don't even know it, to a third party. That third party's watching and waiting for just such an opportunity, and you're about to do a big deal transfer, and they just suddenly spoof the party you think you're sending to at the right timing, and here's my transactional data, my ETF information, please send it here, and you don't know any better, you're back and forth, you think it's me.
Well, they couldn't do that if you had digital signatures.
That's the other thing, right? Like,
that's the digital signature is to prevent the man in the middle exploit like that.
Yeah. That's happening, I can assure you it's happening right now. Like,
because
we transact. Businesses transact every day by email. We don't have that level of sophistication for every company we interface with. Even if we wanted to, it's not just our decision, it's the other side's, right?
Yeah, you both have to have, yes. You both have to have,
it's going to the public service.
Now, I saw earlier you had the ability to have conditions, though, within the contract, right?
That's right, yeah.
So would that be something where we could say, if it's already delivered, don't allow a new transaction in?
There's, and again, some other slide.
You named it before.
Pardon?
That's the state proof, is it?
It's the state proof, yeah. So the short answer is yes, and there are mechanisms for writing those contracts. So, I mean, and you'd need to sit down and work out the protections that you need, right?
Yeah.
Transactions have to be signed by both parties before they're entered into the blockchain, right? A delivery before being received, you check the blockchain to see where that parcel was intended to go, right? That's already in the blockchain, and that has to be true before you can sign for the delivery. Things like that, right? So, and you'd have to build that data model and that rule set. But the thing is, once you've built the data model and the rule set, then each time there's an exchange of information, first of all, you're secure in the knowledge of the provenance of that information. And secondly, the information is the same for both you, the receiver, and them, the sender, because you're using this shared distributed ledger. That's the advantage.
But there is still, you know, there are still points that when I talk, I'll give a specific example, and then I'll point out some points of vulnerability, and you'll see that it's very hard to deal with all of them, even though, you know, sometimes you say, oh, yes, we've solved this. There are still points of vulnerability.
It solves some problems, not all problems.
Yeah.
And it would be,
But
misleading.
Like the email example, it's better because you have digital signatures, and you know that's a way to solve that specific problem.
Yeah. So, moving reasonably quickly through this section because I am conscious of the time. So, I put this section in just so it might, you know, like the mention of contracts earlier, tweak your mind to some ideas or applications based on examples in other fields. So this. Some of the things that are being done now with blockchain technology. And I'll give you these slides later, and you can follow all those links to actually see the example. So obviously, it's being used for all kinds of currency and financial service, everything from payments themselves, gift cards, if you can believe it, financial services galore. Also, a lot of business networking, auditing, compliance. There's an agreements network, for example. Markets can be set up. There's that link is one for paying for coffee shipments. Asset management, supply chain management, and as we've talked about already, shipping applications. There's the what I've got there is something called Maersk. It's an IBM consortium with a number of different companies to have this, basically this shipping and trade platform. Different resources and industry are beginning to use blockchain. For example, in agriculture, the first example is an almond market for, a blockchain almond market. Tree planting, always one of those industries where you report you've planted 1,000 but you've actually planted 100. Now you can track that using a tree planting blockchain mechanism. Mining, there's a frequently told story about proving the provenance of diamonds using blockchain. Energy, power ledgers, carbon offsets. I know we're not doing that in Ontario anymore, but we will again. And there's a blockchain mechanism for that.
Just curious, I don't know if you know the content, but on the forestry side, how does blockchain help them?
I'd have to look that up.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm curious on that one.
Yeah. That's why I put the link there.
No, that's great.
Yeah. Because I'd have to go back. Government, education, and health. This is a small sampling of a very wide field. Currency, of course. Venezuela has issued its own blockchain-backed currency because their existing currency had like a gazillion percent inflation. Registries, the Netherlands using blockchain and a pilot project for land registries. Shipping again, but in this case to register ships. There's an example I wanted to bring up. NRC IRAP recently launched a blockchain mechanism that displays all of the and records all of the I don't want to say contracts because that's not quite right, but the financial support that it gives to different companies. And if I had internet, I'd actually click on that link and show you. So that's something that's running right now. That's running on an Ethereum network using a starts with a D, Stephen. it's on a later slide.
It was built by a company.
It was built by a company.
And it's built specifically to ensure that somebody doesn't hack and change the results. Is that the idea?
Well, it was built specifically as a demonstration project. But what's nice is, this has been published as a blockchain, which means now NRC isn't the only ones with the copy, right? Anyone else, what's on the Ethereum blockchain, right? It's out there, right? So we can't come back later, or nobody can come back later and say, well, no, that amount of support was half what you said it was or whatever. So that provenance is there. But it's also, it's a good way for us to distribute the data, because now people know that it came from NRC, it could not have come from anywhere else. It's a fact, it's not fake, right? And that's important.
It's an interesting, every government that ever comes in and takes over for an existing government that's been there for a while, the first thing they say is, all the problems we want to do, we can't afford to do them.
Because the books are off.
Tell you personally, on the business side, one frustration I have is, we have great tools to look at our current financial state.
Mm-hmm.
But if something changes, then I'm looking at the current state.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know that something's changed unless I'm comparing. So literally, I will create weekly reports, and I only create them not to study them, but to have them.
It is
my personal ability to go back, and if I see something on the current state that's weird, I can go back and start comparing. Yeah. I would love a financial blockchain almost mechanism, because it is so loosey-goosey, believe it or not, in that financial side. It is an amazingly unregulated space.
Yeah.
And cooking the books is not around just a person, like an organization. It could be anybody who's just made a mistake and you know, did a reversal and, and what have you. And it's very, it's all there somewhere.
Yeah.
But it'd be nice to know what's changing as it changes.
When another question is, when you're doing all of this transaction and stuff like that, is there, does anybody have a rule of thumb overhead figure for the add-on to the data in terms of how much data increase you're creating by putting it in the encryption and so on and so forth?
I'm not sure exactly. You mean like just the size of the data?
Right. So in basically this and the overhead. So, you know, if you start out with a, say there was a soil sensor in agriculture, right?
Yeah.
And it's so many bits. If you start encrypting and doing all of that sort of stuff, what's the...
There is an overhead, but frankly, it isn't a big one. And I don't have a rule of thumb number, like, you know, 10%, 5%, whatever. But, you know, in the work that I've done digging into this, I haven't seen this raised as a significant issue. You know, the overhead of producing a new proof of work is a significant issue. But, you know, encryption algorithms are very efficient. And they're always trying to make them faster. And I read about faster and faster algorithms, for example. You probably saw I had a bunch of them listed in the previous slide there. But in terms of the actual addition to the data, that's negligible, right? But here's the thing, too. In data management generally, it is becoming best practice to never change data. You only add new data. That's becoming the standard in the field. And when you have databases where you go in, revise an existing number, that's no longer being considered good practice. We just had a case with that with one of our government clients where they're looking at their data management system. We did an analysis of that, and that was the big issue of the analysis was, look, you're overwriting existing data. You don't know what the provenance of that is. You don't know what the history of that is. So,
it's not the Phoenix project, is it?
Pardon? No, it's not Phoenix. No, I wish it was. I wish we could have helped them with that. A lot of the problems of Phoenix you see replicated in other areas, in other data management approaches by government, and department by department. Now they're addressing them. That means, you know, you're producing a lot more data because you're basically replicating each one of these cells each time it changes. But, you know, a site that does that is Wikipedia, right? With Wikipedia, every time you make an edit, you don't change the content, you create a new piece of content on top. Another example where this happens is GitHub, which is a global open source software repository. It's huge. Microsoft just bought it for, what was it, $2 billion? I forget the number. But again, when you revise some software, you don't replace the existing software, you create a new version, you layer. That's becoming the standard. And just as an aside, and it's beyond the scope of this discussion, but the core technology used by something like GitHub is the same as the core technology used by some of these blockchain networks. It's called Merkle chains. Coins. Now, Andre will talk a lot about Bitcoin, so I'm not going to go into that in too much depth. As I said, 115,000 nodes, that's a moving target. So I got that number back in June, so it's probably up a bit now. Each node connects to 8 other nodes. There's what Bitcoin looks like. And Bitcoin tracks transactions only, right? So the state, if you can call it that, in Bitcoin is the unspent transaction outputs. Now, part of what we discussed earlier was the cost of using Bitcoin, right? And so, as I mentioned, there's the 115,000 nodes, and then there are what are called second layer solutions, for example, the Lightning Network. And the idea of the Lightning Network, and there are others similar to it, right? You use Bitcoin as a platform, and then you conduct transactions at this second layer using the states in Bitcoin as your reference point. And there's the list of transactions, there's the list of people in the transaction, etc., that you can use to ground your transactions. I'll give you a simple example. So you're gonna have a poker game with your friends, right? So you all bring your money, right? But you know, it's really it's risky and expensive to actually exchange money every time, right? You have a hand, so you put your money off to one side, right? We'll call that the Bitcoin network, and that money will give us tokens, which we'll use. We'll use those tokens for our poker game, fling them back and forth, but no real cash has changed hands yet, right? Once we're done our poker game, we add up our chips, we go back to the money, now we do the Bitcoin transaction and allocate the money according to whoever has how many coins. That's how it works, right? And it's computer programmer, so there's a gazillion variations on the theme, but that's how you can leverage a high overhead system like Bitcoin to do a low overhead transaction network like Lightning. Andre's going to talk about that kind of approach and others similar in more detail. Ethereum, I love this phrase, Bitcoin is digital gold, but Ethereum is the silicon. The big difference between Ethereum and Bitcoin is the data that's recorded in the blockchain itself, at least that's my take on it. And specifically, it's recording states, which allows you to record contracts, which means you can have contracts in Ethereum as well as transactions. Really important. There's a bunch of stuff that's been built on top of that. You can, for example, build distributed virtual corporations. There's one called the DAO out there, which is basically a collection of contracts between people. For writing these contracts, there's a language called Solidity, which is a bit of a pain to use, but as you'll see, again, it's low level, and it being computer programmers, they built higher levels so that you have a stack of technologies. One of the things to note about Ethereum is that because you can have conditional transactions, that allows you to write applications that run on the Ethereum network. These are called decentralized applications, or dApps. And as of last June, there were something like 1,600 of them. There's more now of these decentralized applications. They're doing the same kind of thing, right? They're riding on top of the Ethereum network. Ethereum's had its issues over the years. It got hacked. They had to do a hard fork. Now again, Ethereum itself wasn't hacked, but the endpoints were hacked, right? Where people are putting things in and taking things out. So they did a hard fork. So you have a thing called Ethereum Classic, which uses the old rules, and then Ethereum, which uses the new rules. It's early days, right? And there's still some risk. I would say Ethereum has developed into a mature network now. That would be my call. But we heard about permissioned networks earlier. Ripple and Stellar are good examples of that. Ripple basically is backed. Ripple is the company. And then there's a coin, RXP, I think it is, XRP. So it's backed by a bunch of banks, and they've developed their own permissioned blockchain network using this coin, and they're basically using it to replace existing transactional, international transactional systems such as SWIFT. So early days yet, obviously it hasn't replaced SWIFT yet. It might never if it turns out that there's problems, but they're working on it. But interestingly, Interledger, a way for ledgers to interoperate with each other, is a new web standard being discussed and developed by the World Wide Web Consortium.
Are these all rides even on top of the Bitcoin?
These are separate.
These are pinned to it, like almost like the currency's pinned to
gold. All three of these three things, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Ripple, three separate networks.
Yeah. Bitcoin is an exception. It's the one that got the most publicity, but it's the one also under so much scrutiny because of the shenanigans going on.
These are total separate.
Totally separate. Networks. Yeah. So, and but we'll talk in just a few minutes about that clock hasn't moved.
No, it doesn't work.
It is 7:11.
Okay, thanks. I'm sitting there, it's like, oh, I got 20 minutes left.
Time stands still when you're talking fun.
Yeah. So, just, I mean, because the question you just asked is a good one, right? What if you want to use both Bitcoin and Ripple and maybe Ethereum or maybe one of the other 900 or whatever different coins there are out there? There are exchanges, both centralized ones like Coinbase or Binance, and decentralized ones like Altcoin. We talk about that a lot. And they're what you might think they are, right? Exchange X number of Bitcoins for X number of Ethereum, etc. There are networks or network technology being developed, I wouldn't say it's anything near mainstream, to allow Ethereum and Bitcoin and others of these coin networks to interoperate. And then us as individuals can have a wallet, and our wallet might contain X number of this coin, X number of that coin, etc. I've left that blank because that's part of Andre's talk.
I'll say a currency exchange today, but
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Didn't one exchange ever be used as a node? Would they ever be used as an authority of some sort?
Centralized, maybe. Decentralized, you probably couldn't. A centralized one, there is that possibility. Yeah. I'm not sure how well it would be accepted by the wider community, but you know, technically it's possible.
The exchanges and networks thing kind of brings two things up in my head. Is one, you know, right now, to your point, it's not different networks aren't pervasive, right?
Yeah.
At some point they will be. So, you know, if we start off, let's say we use Ethereum, like, just because it's cool, you put contracts, awesome. So we go Ethereum, and then somebody else that may become a partner somewhere else in the workforce in the near future decided to go a different path.
Yeah.
Or a different structure of some sort. Is there going to be an opportunity for us to somehow inter-network so that we can share our chains of some sort, or at least have them provide some consensus and, you know?
That's what they're working on with the interoperable blockchain systems.
You think it's going to be focused more though on cryptocurrency versus...
That's where they'll begin, for sure.
That's where I get squirreled here a little bit. I know Andre's going to say that they're one and the same as we did last time. Yeah. I get a little squirreled on this. I mean, I look at the currency side of the fence. That's how I see, like, encryption that secures electronic currency. That's kind of how I see that working, whether it's Bitcoin or all the rest of them out there. The reason I don't have any, all it takes is one government to just say one day it's illegal. Right? We have our own currency, so buzz off. You can't use it. It's illegal. The tube it goes, right? It's worth nothing. I see its use. I don't like its long-term viability in terms of an investment or a something I would hold. Anything that drops by 80% one day doesn't really excite me, right?
Yeah, but I mean that you're thinking of Bitcoin and similar networks as a value store, basically. A way of storing value. I wouldn't do that at this point, simply because of what you just said. The volatility, it's in my issue section later, which isn't complete, but the volatility, it makes it a really bad value store.
Warren Buffett, he kind of said it one time. He said that looking at this, like, like a commodity, gold, mm-hmm. a dollar bill, something yeah. like that, isn't the way he looks at these things yeah. as like a check would be. It's a medium.
Yeah. That's the way to look at it, right?
Yes.
I wouldn't store value in it, but as a way of you know, just as a technology that helps you have certain kinds of records, for example, and certain kinds of exchanges, yeah, then it's great, right? If you are simply using Bitcoin as a reference point, as a way of triangulating, say, right? It doesn't matter whether it's $1,000 or $10,000 or $20,000, right? It's X Bitcoin, right? And you're using that to triangulate your data, right? So, you know, it can work as a ledger even if it's volatile as a currency store. It's I don't know a better way of saying that.
Well, I mean, Bitcoin, it's confuses two things. Like the bitcoins themselves have a value in that you can, you know, it has an exchange rate with US dollars, right? So there's an exchange rate between bitcoins and US dollars. So Bitcoin has a value in US dollars.
Yeah.
But it's the Bitcoin network records transactions.
Yeah.
That, you know, so you can record transactions that also have a value in US dollars, but it doesn't have to be Bitcoin, or you can record transactions that don't have any value in US dollars. So the transaction could be, you know, I told a joke to this person, and then, you know, it could be the joke network. Well, the jokes don't have any value because they don't have an exchange rate with the US dollar, but then you're using the Bitcoin type network to exchange jokes and to see who told the joke to who else.
Yeah,
you know, those are two things that are
a record almost.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Use a billionth of the Bitcoin, right? You know? And then it doesn't matter what it's worth. It's not worth anything, right? But, you know, it's your a billionth of the Bitcoin. That's your basic unit. You'll trade those. You know, that works. It's kind of like penny anti-poker, right? Doesn't matter if you're using American money or Venezuelan money. You're betting pennies. It's not worth anything.
I think for our use case, I mean, it's fascinating stuff, but, you know, our use case is around how do we just create that proof of record, that unassailable proof of record, that 100%, that if something were to go wrong, we'd have the earliest indication possible. Mm-hmm. You know, the biggest nightmare today, if you own a network or a business or data, is getting hacked and not knowing about it. That to me is the worst. You know, someone in your house, you want your alarm to start triggering and start alerting right away. Mm-hmm. If you don't have an alarm system or they bypass it, they can be in your house all day, rooting through your stuff, redoing your stuff. So to me, that's the value we see in trying to implement this.
Well, I'm going to talk a bit about that later, but not as necessarily broad as you're talking about that. But we'll see.
So, platforms are basically mechanisms for setting up one of these networks that you can use for yourself. One of them is Hyperledger Fabric. It's a Linux project, all open source. There are libraries and applications supported by IBM to enable this. It's set up with data models, access control, etc. It's a private permissioned network system. But it's proven to have some traction. I've actually looked at it fairly closely. I like it. Andre doesn't.
So would this be instead of trying to set up your own kind of private permission network, you say, hey, you know, IBM's done a lot of legwork on this.
Yeah.
Or they're worldwide. You're going to run on their permissions network.
Not exactly. You'll use their technology or the technology that they've developed to build your own network. So you'd actually be separate. You're not part of Ethereum, you're not part of Bitcoin, you're not part of any of those. You've just set up your own private permission blockchain.
Can you do the smart contracts on that?
Yeah.
But having said that, if somebody was going to invest into an exchange broker, IBM would have had that with Ethereum and blockchain, right?
No, they're doing it, they're probably using Hyperledger with their consortium with Merck's.
Mm-hmm. Right? But so there wouldn't be an exchange. If somebody was on another network, they wouldn't be able to, they haven't put in the allocation of being compatible to that network?
No.
No, they'd be separate.
They're not compatible with Bitcoin or Ethereum. They're competitors.
Yeah.
Well, today, maybe that's the state, right? I think given how everything's kind of so source, they might, to your point, bridge that, which then we could lever.
There are projects underway to create this interoperability, but you know, I wouldn't bet the house on them yet.
Yeah.
Maybe later, but not yet.
So what does it say to you then in your mind, Stephen? What is this, what kind of, like, getting onto the Hyperledger, what is that?
Well, again, these are your basic advantages of blockchain, right? You and your customers are all working on this single data record that you share, first of all. That data record is permanent and has provenance, so you're not overwriting data, you're layering data on top. And then thirdly, because it's permissioned, other people aren't writing to this. You know who's writing to this, you can track the provenance of any transaction, and so if there is a bad actor, you can detect it relatively quickly.
But I mean, in terms of the Hyperledger that IBM's putting out, mm-hmm. is the idea we build our private network, you guys would also be using IBM, you build your little private network and IBM's kind of IBM.
No, you build one Hyperledger network with that technology, and then you and your customers or your clients all use that network.
Yeah,
it's a developer kit. That's a good way to look at it. And some of these others are in the same category. ARC is another one. I haven't looked at this one in detail. It's called the WordPress of crypto.
So who's the power behind ARC? Who's their backers?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up. It came across my desk this past week. I've got some tabs on my browser that I have to follow up on, but I thought I'd better put it in there. What caught my eye was the Ledger Nano S little device that you can use to work on the ARC network. And,
an Amazon screenshot for that
sake? It might be. I've clipped off the bottom that says order now.
So the concept here, that's your key to get into the network?
Yeah, right. And store data. So you store your network data on that key.
Security might have problems
plugging keys in there. No, well, I mean, we'll talk about keys.
Andre's going to talk about that.
Andre will talk about that, yeah. Truffle is the framework that was used to create the IRAP blockchain. So there are different aspects of Truffle. There's Ganache, which is a one-click blockchain, Drizzle, a library for making writing these applications. I know.
Sounds like somebody's got a sweet
tooth. But again, this is a development framework that'll allow you to build services that run on the Ethereum network, which is what the NRC thing does. So I'm including that because we know that that works, and there are people in NRC who have worked with that. This is a different thing entirely, but I wanted to mention this just to tweak your mind about things. This is Interplanetary File System. It's using the same sort of Merkle chain hash kind of technology, but it uses it as a mechanism of content addressing. So the idea here is you have something like, say, a web page. You run that web page through an algorithm that produces a hash. You then use that hash as the address of that web page. You distribute the web page with the hash, and now anybody can store that web page, so you can store it, he can store it, he can store it.
Like version control for the web.
It's like version control for the web, exactly.
It's kind of neat, so they would inject anything into it, it would immediately kind of fly out?
Yeah, you cannot change the contents of the web page without changing the hash. And so me, right, if I have a browser, so the mechanism to actually access content is similar in a way to a content distribution network, or it's similar in a way to, what's that download streaming thing?
Torrent?
BitTorrent, yeah. So, where basically you get it from anywhere. You get it from your closest source. You actually get it from different sources and it'll reassemble it for you. So it doesn't matter where it came from, but you get it and then you check it against the hash to verify that the contents are indeed what they were promised to be. And so you can get, you can have this distributed storage, but still be secure in the idea that the contents you're getting are real contents and they're not corrupted contents.
It's really interesting.
So there's another thing, interplanetary linked data, to do much the same sort of thing, but with linked data. There's just so much potential in there.
secure, basically to secure everything.
Yeah, secure and version everything. So yeah. I've got, there's just a couple quibbles in the back of my head about how you're linking one, version 1.1 with version 1.2 and making sure that you have provenance of versions, but still, I think that's going to be pretty important in
the future.
Well,
just think about the phishing nightmare today. So that could solve that issue immediately.
Yeah.
Because when you would get phished and go to a website, if that was not a legitimate website, the browser would know that the hash is different.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least flag it saying, hey, this doesn't appear to be RBC Bank, so you know. It's wrong, and that's where people go.
So, it's similar to the way even now with secure web HTTPS, where your content will be signed, right? So when you receive a web page, the web page has been signed by the sender, and if the web page doesn't match up with the signature, that you've been compromised.
Only a practical question here, and I think we have very interesting discussion. Yep. Are you limited by 12 o'clock? If the meeting is a bit longer, is it okay for everyone?
I have another meeting at 1 in Gatineau,
We have a call. At
noon, at 12?
So I'm basically done. We've already raised the issues. And in any case, these are mostly blank slides because I ran out of time.
Wait, a picture there, Stephen.
I know.
Is that your backyard?
Yeah, that's my backyard.
You might have grubs.
That's just the result of a Google image search on the phrase "some issues."
That's cool.
So and I thought, that's. The positive and the negative, so, or summer and winter or whatever, I kind of like it. So, conceptual issues, is it too centralized? Is it too decentralized? We've raised some of these issues already. The cost and energy consumption issue, which is a big one, because Bitcoin now is using the same amount of energy as some not so small countries, that's an issue. It's changing power prices in Quebec, stuff like that. Social and ethical issues. It's a decentralized, network, and it's hard to impose a legal framework on that, and that creates a host of social and ethical issues.
That's real quick. That might sound a bit utopic, but how is cryptocurrency is written by quantum computing and stuff like that?
That's a technical issue and nailed it. Yeah.
They're all going to get caught.
The incentive not to cheat on Bitcoin is that it costs too much to solve the proof of work. But with quantum computing, it no longer costs too much to solve the proof of work. I think it's a significant problem. And so personally, I don't think proof of work survives quantum computing.
No.
So other methods will be necessary. That's my view. But I, a lot of people have that
because view. I'm wondering if currently, I'm saying like Chinese people are having like their servers, or Russians, and are trying to hack those ledgers and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah. If the Joker is out there and just wants to burn down the system and he has enough money, he can do it. I think that's an issue, personally.
But that's based on proof of work.
Yeah.
Great.
That's my bit. And now Andre will correct my errors.
And Stephen, you'll be able to provide the presentation after?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Good.
Yeah.
You probably, I don't know if Andre has slides, but it doesn't look like it. So you can probably turn on
the
lights. It's close to my allotted time. Within about 10 minutes. It's 11, 12.
So now it's really difficult to reach.
Can I get?
Yeah.
Did anyone download the Red Wallet app?
Yep,
I did. It's still empty. It's not like I have money.
I'm not an NFC people. I'm not going to give it. Open. I don't know how to turn it off.
I think this is how you turn it off. I don't usually look that much.
Well, I've got slides from the computer.
Yeah.
Not nearly enough, man.
You got nothing. Yeah, zero.
I got zero.
I have a great new wallet.
Oh, you did create?
Yeah.
Did you create it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so